All right. Welcome to our Mental Illness and Pop Culture podcast. This is Adam.
This is Brock.
This is Leanne.
I'm Scott.
And today we're going to talk to you guys about the 2016 film Moonlight. It is directed by Barry Jenkins. It won 3 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Supporting Actor. It stars, here's all the names. Trevante Rhodes, Andre Holland, Janelle Monáe, Ashton Sanders, Jaharl, I hope I'm saying that right, Jerome, Naomi Harris, and Mahershala Ali, who was the one who won the supporting actor for this film. This movie, there's so much to say about it. Just to kind of give a brief synopsis, it's a coming-of-age film about a young man who, I always say his name wrong when I'm not, like, watching the movie. Chiron. Yes. So, Chiron. And it shows three stages in this young man's life. One is when he's probably, I was guessing maybe like five or six. It's like early school age. Then one is about high school. And then one is him as a young man or a young adult. There are so many different subplots in this movie between socioeconomic status, race, drugs, sexuality. I mean, there are so many different intertwined stories. I absolutely love this film. I remember it was released last year, and it was about 2 days after the election, and I wasn't feeling too hot, and I was like, I'm gonna go see Moonlight, back when I had Facebook, and everyone was like, do not go see this film if you're not feeling happy, because it's not the happiest film. But I went and saw it anyway, and I want to talk about reactions the first time versus seeing it again. But I don't know how much I should say in the beginning. Do you want me to give a little bit more about his life and kind of what happens there?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it starts out where his nickname in the beginning is Little, and we see that is it's the title on the screen. We see a lot of issues when it comes to being bullied at school. His mother has a drug issue, a drug addiction. He ends up kind of getting support from a drug dealer who actually is selling drugs to his mother, and that's kind of where he finds this adult figure, this male figure in his life. Also, his girlfriend or wife, I'm not really sure if they specify, is kind of almost a mother figure to Little. Then after that, it goes into his high school, where he's being bullied quite a bit. We get to see more issues with his mom, who seems to be even further into her drug addiction. He still has that relationship with his kind of adopted, not officially, but adopted parents almost. And he ends up fighting back at one of the times that he's bullied and is sent away to, I think, a juvenile detention center. And then the final one, where his nickname is now Black, he is living, it originally took place in Miami. He moves to Atlanta, Georgia, and he is now dealing drugs himself. And it kind of tells the story of him reconnecting with one of his childhood friends from both periods that we saw in his life. So I guess I just want to take a minute and kind of get everyone's like initial reaction, just maybe a sentence or two about what you thought when watching this.
I am addicted to the word authenticity because it's a personal plight, and we all go through these phases of new versions of ourselves and new realizations. And so just kind of side note, and you referred to it a little bit, but the movie's almost done in 3 chapters. And so that's a really cool way to follow it. And I think it's symbolic of our lives in this. And so my favorite thing, those who know me, is I have a thing called hashtag moments of authenticity. So that is my initial reaction to this movie. So I love it very, very much because I think it is just such a clear, genuine depiction of this journey this child and then man is on.
Well, I want to say I had not seen the film before we decided to do a podcast on it. So it was unknown for me and very powerful. Holy cow. As you alluded to, Adam, so many different factors swirling around, many related to identity issues, I am also fascinated by the phenomena of the butterfly effect, which is often cliched in movies, but we really see here this idea of sensitive dependence on initial conditions. And, I mean, starting out with this scene of Chiron being chased into an abandoned house and then rescued by a man we later come to know as Juan, and just how the different elements unfold in his life that almost set him up, and at the same time, this quest, as Leanne said, for authenticity by him and all characters. Mm-hmm. And also lots of great literary elements or film things like transitions and lots of things that repeat themselves, phenomenal use of music, and more. We'll come back to those.
Okay. Brock?
You know, I saw this movie in the theater probably about the same time you did, Adam. And, you know, I really liked this movie. I love this movie. And in fact, I even put a message on the Nyuko board for people to definitely see this movie from a counseling program. It depicts an African-American male who, you know, is coming out. It really hasn't strongly come out, and it just, you know, it was just a strong message, and I really enjoyed it. I think it was brilliantly done. The actors were great, in all three phases. From when you look at Chiron's character or Little, all three of the actors were they worked so well together in transitioning from, you know, from their different age groups. I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. It was great.
Yeah, and I, you know, after the first time I saw it, I walked out of the theater and I had so many people warning me, "Oh, it's so sad, it's so sad." And I don't know where I was, maybe not mentally with it, because I walked out thinking like, well, it's not as sad as what people made it out to be. But watching it this time, there are definitely levels of heartbreak in it that mm-hmm. I see from a different angle. And I also wanted to, I didn't mention the writer, Terrell McCraney. And I wanted to make sure we mention him, because not only did he win the Academy Award for this, but he actually wrote the play that this was supposed to be based on. The play, which actually gets a little shout out in the film, from Juan's character, is called In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And it's actually especially as a young child, is based on his real life. His mother did have issues with drugs and actually died of AIDS after, I'm assuming, infection due to drug use. So I wanted to throw that out there because the writing is so beautiful.
It is. It really is. And I'm later going to want to come back to that line, because I think, in addition to its real life value, there's lots of symbols that are thrown in there. But going back to the real life author, mm-hmm. He also, as you said, had this kind of mentoring parental father figure who was a drug dealer, and he said in an interview that it was one of his first encounters with reality when his mother told him that this man was gone and would never come back because he had died.
Yeah. I love the complex relationships in this, not only between the characters, but it forces you to question some of your own stereotypes, mm-hmm. because what we typically see as bad, maybe drug dealing and that kind of profession, the man is so sweet and wonderful, and also, you know, we question masculinity when it comes into like sexual orientation. And I love every single complex wind and twine that this movie has.
I'm glad that you bring up the part about Juan and specifically that lack of stereotype. Mm-hmm. Like, I was confused. So to review, Juan is an adult gentleman who is a drug dealer who befriends Chiron and kind of saves him from a situation in their original meeting. But I was confused. So I saw this movie twice, and by the second time, there were some things that helped me understand it a little bit better, which we can talk about or not. But I didn't get it, or I didn't want to get it the first time. I don't think I fully understood that character on first watch. Like, I knew he was a part of it, and I knew more when the interaction happens between Sharon's mom and him on the road, but I still didn't want to believe it because it's so far out. He's this big, strong, empowering, lovely, big heart, taking care of a little kid guy, and so how does this work? So I'm glad that you mentioned that because it is the opposite and probably very, very real.
Mm-hmm.
Let me bring up something really quick, and it's later in the movie, and not to give this part away, but later when Sharon is an adult male and he's speaking to his friend from high school, he refers to the term tapping. Is that what it's, trapping?
Trapping. Yeah.
And so I had to look that up. He said that's what he's doing now. And the interesting definition of that is that it is absolutely selling, moving illegal substances. But the interesting way that it is defined is that it is for accumulation of wealth.
Hmm.
So I think that changes kind of the stereotypical view or what I would think. I think drug dealers do drugs. I don't know that, but I guess that's what I would have thought in my brain before seeing this. We never see him take any
or
Sharon. I don't think so either. So I guess that was part of it in my mind. But it's interesting that that phrase, which was coined in Atlanta, actually says for accumulation of wealth.
Well, and it's funny you bring that up because if you look at the film, most of it is taking place in like inner city. And then you go to their house, which seems more suburban and very nice. Like it's a nice home. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's funny that you mentioned the wealth thing because he seems to be doing pretty well for himself. He has a beautiful car, a beautiful house, a really nice area, it seems like. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, see, I have a different perspective of drug dealers, okay? They are entrepreneurs. They are business people.
Right.
And I don't think they want to use their own product. They want to make the money off their own product. So I don't, when you say drug dealers as drug users, I that's not what I envision. I envision what this Juan character was all about. I envision maybe a little bit more hardcore, always carrying weapons and guns, maybe with multiple people around him. But we got to remember, this took place back in 1979, was when it started out, I believe, the 1970s. So it wasn't as prevalent as a thing right now, with the drugs and the being a dealer.
Yeah,
that makes sense. And I kind of also, while we're on the subject of Juan, like, typically in African-American or Black culture, it's even a little bit, I mean, most men in general tend to have the stereotype of being uncomfortable around gay people. A little bit even more, I think, in the African-American or Black culture. And it goes against that as well, because he's so, like, he doesn't care about it one way or the other. And I just love that part about this movie as well, because it challenges these stereotypes that we think exist and that we expect is going to be happening in this film. And it didn't with him. He was, I don't know, such a flawed character that I just kind of loved.
Right. I agree with you on that, Adam, because that's the one thing when they use the F word, right, at the dinner table, and then he corrected it. Well, he kind of looked kind of discomfort by the word himself, Juan was. And then the boy asked, well, what does it mean? What does it mean? And he just came out and said, it's a nice, just not so nice word for gay people. And the way he put that was such more intelligent and care, that you didn't expect that from that.
I completely agree. I love that conversation. I kind of want to focus on that scene a little bit if we can, because he does ask, what is this F word? And, he says it's a word to make gay people feel bad. And he goes something along the lines of, like, don't let anyone call you that. You don't have to let anyone call you that. And then he says, unless. And the camera pans over to his girlfriend or wife. And she made this face that I immediately started laughing. I don't know why I thought it was so funny. But she does this face like, nope, stop your sentence right there. Like, we're not going to explain this any more than we have to. And I just loved it for some. I loved it for some reason. And then he asks, like, am I gay? Like, is this what I am? And he said, like, that's something you don't need to worry about right now. And I just thought that was such a great answer for a young man who's questioning his sexuality at even such a young age, being called those names, being bullied because of these things. I think it was handled beautifully.
And some of that being bullied coming from literally his size. And so he has the nickname Little. And one of the very first words of, I think, the whole film is something about being soft. Mm-hmm. And so he's got this identity where he's kind of not like the other kids. Mm-hmm. And when Juan, we haven't mentioned this, when Juan first comes across Little, he doesn't speak. And it isn't really until Teresa has this kind of soft approach with him that he does start to open up. And this moment that we're calling attention to right now at the dinner table, I would call it like brutal honesty, not only related to sexual identity, but also he asks about, are you a drug dealer? He asks Juan that. And he asks Juan, do you know my mom? Do you sell her drugs? And Juan is honest. Juan does not lie to him. And then Juan says, Little says, I hate her. And Juan says, I hated my mom too. I miss her like hell now. And so I think that there's both some foreshadowing there, but there's also this going back to questioning our values and this sort of, for lack of a better term, black and whiteness. And instead, you know, there's a grayness of right and wrong and good and evil, and nobody or nothing is absolutely something. Mm-hmm. It's all somewhere in between. This movie is just these swirling factors coming together.
And it's funny because we talk about it like it is powerful. It's so powerful. But when you're sitting there watching it, it is a quiet movie. I mean, yeah, there was maybe a gun or two in it, but there's never like a violent, like there's never a firing of a gun. We do see one or two fights or whatnot. But I mean, the movie itself is a very calm movie. Like, it pretty much stays at, like, a 4. You know what I mean? And I find it so interesting that we're describing it with such, like, passion and excitement. When you're really watching it, I feel like we're more excited talking about it now than most people act during the film. Yet it's superbly acted and whatnot.
Well, it's interesting that the climax, and I'm not sure what we would define as the true climax of the movie, but whatever it is housed in emotion and development and dialogue, or dialogue that becomes emotion and development. So there's not this big, even, this happens. So it's
very typical of a play. You know what I mean? Like, plays tend to, you have a limited stage, you have 3 acts, and the dialogue is so important because it's what not everyone can see the stage as well. So you need that dialogue there. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that with movies that are adapted from plays.
Well, and when we go to the climax of the film, we're close to it because we could have different opinions on what that is. But it does involve this re-encountering with this childhood friend. And so much of that centered around moments of authenticity or lifetimes of authenticity. Mm-hmm. And in the time between the chapters and during the time leading up, so much, whereas this early Chiron that we meet as a boy is unbelievably authentic. And then there's that moment where he has to transition. He, in order to survive, he must change. And that change is caused by one of the moments of violence, which is directly coming from this childhood friend. Mm-hmm. Now, they later meet each other again, And my perception was that this childhood friend, and Kevin is his name, he has, and he's had hardship in his life, but he's now presenting as soft and very authentic. And Chiron has had to now become hard, and Kevin is questioning, you know, who are you? Because he's not seeing that authentic Chiron, or actually Kevin always called him Black.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like there was a role reversal that had taken place.
And I think that one of the beautiful things, I mean, like you said, he had to become hard, I think, and he did when it came to like the juvenile detention center and his business or whatnot as a drug dealer. But it was a choice as well. And I think that's an interesting part about this movie is we see many choices that take place that influence where this person ends up in life. But at the same time, we're all dealt a deck of cards that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
He comes from a family that looks like it's lower socioeconomic status. His mother has a drug addiction. He's a Black homosexual male. So, I mean, there is a level of this is what I have. And then there's also the choices that I made got me here as well. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I always struggle with that choice idea because of what led to the juvenile detention center
mm-hmm.
was this being bullied
mm-hmm.
by Kevin, who was provoked by Terrell, I think was the name of the real bully, and then Chiron is in the principal's or the dean's or someone's office, and she says to him, if you were a real man, you would press charges, and there'd be four other knuckleheads sitting here with you.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you don't know the real story. And he goes home, he puts his face in that sink full of ice to try to heal, and then he goes back, and he gets revenge.
Yeah. And I feel that, though, I'm never condoning violence ever, but I mean, there was a little part of me that kind of rooted for that violence at that moment.
Yeah.
But I do feel like that was a choice. It was a choice to go back and seek revenge. And I agree that, like, outing the other people and saying that they are the ones that are bullying me or fighting may have been worse for him in the long run, I think is what he was trying to allude to. But we also see like Kevin, who went to prison for a while as well, and he came out softer.
Yeah.
And so I do feel that there's an element of choice to it.
I'm going to say you have persuaded me.
Okay.
It's funny. I struggle with this all the time. So good. You've made a convincing
point. One point I'd like to make though with that part was if we go back to when he was little, right? And he was sitting at the dinner table. And Juan is telling him, don't ever let anybody call you that word, or however he phrased it. You notice that was the trigger word into the transition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Brock, going back also to what Juan had, the Juan's story about his grand, or about the old lady in Cuba, saying mm-hmm. that Black men in the Black boys or Black men in the moonlight look blue.
Mm-hmm.
And then Juan says something to the effect of, this is a decision you have to make for yourself. And so it is a series of decisions
mm-hmm.
right. that
take place.
Right. But you can see him having Juan inside of him, and he's contemplating these decisions, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's how much of a strong of an influence Juan had been on his life.
Absolutely.
You know what's kind of funny that goes with this behavior of him making decisions, and I wrote this down really with nowhere to go with it. I didn't intend to bring it up, but early on when we meet his mom, I mean, before she clearly has the issues that evolve, I guess it's when Juan's bringing her back to the apartment. For the first time, she comes running up dressed in medical attire.
Yeah.
Her outfit says LPN. So she's got it together, at least in that moment. But she says, you know, they're having a conversation like, who are you and why do you have my kid? And she says to Juan, he can usually take care of himself. He's good that way. And I remember when I heard that, I was kind of like, what does she mean? He can make SpaghettiOs. But it may be a little foreshadowing to what happens later. Because we don't see him do a great job always in taking... I mean, he's taking care of him. Yeah, I don't think he's taking care of himself throughout the movie. I think it goes back to what Juan said of, you can't let anyone decide for you who you are. But then we watch him be bullied. We watch him put away his sexuality or not come to grips with it till later and bounce around with whatever his mom's doing that he has to respond to. So it's interesting. She says that up front. And I sort of, you know, roll my eyes to it. But as we go, he sort of becomes that.
Yeah. And I hear what you're saying. I think I might disagree with you a little bit on it, because let me give you a key point. Do you remember when he was a little boy and he was getting his bath ready?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He had a huge pot of hot water boiling on the stove. Knew how to do it, put his hand in and checked the heat of it, grabbed a heat towel, and slowly walked it over to throw up his bathtub. So what she said kind of resonated. Like, okay, you know, I was what they call a latchkey kid back in the day, where I was in first grade, and I went home and opened the door myself and had to call my parents when I got me in the house at their office. They weren't home. So
I do think that's what she means. Yeah. I think she means that it's resourceful. And I don't think that she is forecasting that any of these things are going to happen. And I wasn't going to mention it at all, but just kind of going back to that, where we end up seeing a man evolve to taking care of himself and being good that way. That's why I bring it up. Absolutely has to do things that probably a kid his age, in a lot of situations, we may not think that they should have to. Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
And also to kind of go back to that scene, especially like you see him alone I'm assuming a home that has no heated water because he's heating up the water on the stove. He's in the bathtub alone. He's in his room alone. He's in the house alone. I mean, throughout this course of this film, I feel like there's such like it's showing you not just like physically he's alone, but how emotionally and lonely this man has to be. And I mean, it starts from the beginning and goes all the way through. I mean, even till the end in the final scene where it does kind of a flashback.
Right. I completely agree. You know, it's and so in his aloneness and searching for who he is and longing for acceptance and the people from whom he gets that. So Kevin seems to be like really his only friend, mm-hmm. or at least that we are able to observe it. I think his only friend. And yet Kevin is going to later turn on him. Mm-hmm. And his mom, where, you know, attachment theory and the primary caregiver, she turns out to, and she owns up to not loving him when she should have later on. And even Juan, who is maybe the most pivotal figure in his life, dies end of first chapter, beginning of chapter two.
Yeah.
I mean, and so it's like he can't rely on anyone other than himself. And so then now going back to that choice idea, he's moved. He's moved into survival mode.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely, like, when I was saying, like, we are all dealt a hand of cards that we have to deal with either way.
Yeah.
I think that absolutely fits into there. I mean, there's so many places we can go with this, but I guess one of the things I was thinking about was, this came out the same year as Manchester by the Sea, which we also watched.
Yeah.
And I felt almost a connection between Chiron and Lee. With this, like, experiences of loss and experiences of loneliness and PTSD, basically.
Right, trauma.
Yes. And I kept thinking, like, oh my gosh, like, I wonder if I hadn't seen Manchester by the Sea first, if I would have thought this movie was so much sadder than I did initially seeing it. Also, maybe because I think when I was talking to people about it, they were like, he can't be himself. It's so sad. Like, he's this gay man and he can't be himself. And I was like, well, yeah, we feel that for a long time. I'm a gay man. You know what I mean? So I guess maybe I was like, oh, that's not that sad. That's my life. You know what I mean? And I don't think my life has been sad. So I don't know. I don't know where to go from that. But I was thinking a little bit about this connection that I kind of felt between these two characters.
Similarly, I had some thoughts about Manchester by the Sea, partially because of the strong metaphor of water being present, representing, I believe, I mean, water in literature often represents life, rebirth, cleansing. And
it felt a little spiritual, almost religious, like he was being baptized.
Yes. Well, when Juan was teaching Chiron how to swim, it looked like he was baptizing Chiron.
Yeah, exactly. I thought the same thing.
And you know me, I love my little trivia that comes along with it. The actor actually didn't know how to swim when they were filming this. So Mahershala Ali was actually teaching the actor how to swim in that scene, which I thought was so beautiful and authentic and cleansing.
Yes.
Well, there's a couple of beach scenes in this movie, that being the first one. And we've just said that Juan is teaching him how to swim. But we see Chiron in this position where he has to trust. And I think that might be a little bit new. Yeah. And Juan says, I got you. And I could say a whole lot more about that. I mean, they're in choppy waters. He's swimming against the current. I mean, we can metaphor the heck out of it, really, for the situation in life. But then in the second beach scene, he is on the beach with Kevin in another situation that is trusting someone that he cares about, trusting a man in an I got you kind of a situation, really fully present.
Right.
Makes sense?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it seems like, did Kevin live like on the beach or on the waterfront?
Is that how did he show up?
Well, he said, "What, you came to my smoking place?"
Yeah.
And so it might have been one of the times where Chiron's mom, Paula, she often would tell him, "Hey, you can't be in this house tonight because just drugs and prostitution going to be going on." And so I think that he was seeking intimacy and again, authenticity. And so he turned to, and I don't know if Juan had died yet or not, but so he's reaching out to his friend and they end up having a sexual experience together. And Chiron apologizes and Kevin says, you don't have anything to apologize for. Who's powerful and again, but we're coming back to the beach and water as a recurring symbol in this film.
Absolutely. And I mean, there was also a moment where Kevin and Chiron were talking and Kevin says to him, like, you're good at keeping secrets. And I feel like like Chiron at that point was like, he knows my secret and he's still treating me like a friend. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was interested in him. He was attracted to him. And he went there because he knew he would be there.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't see that any other time in the movie where he's seeking out any kind of person. I mean, even when he goes over to Juan and Teresa, is that her name?
Yes.
Teresa's house. He's not going there seeking attention or affection. He's going there to escape and not to talk.
Yeah.
Right. You know what, though? Do you think, though, when he said that on the beach, that I know that you know how to keep secrets? Did you feel like there might have been some kind of prior relationship between these two? I mean, not just playing in football and showing their privates in the closet in elementary school, but I think there seemed like there was just already that intimate connection when he said that.
I don't know if maybe there was a prior relationship, but I think that he was hinting at, like, there's mutual interest, perhaps.
There was definitely a hesitation and an eye connection that lasts longer than a second.
Yeah.
So I think that was the first.
I don't think that the secrets line happened on the beach.
No, it happened in the school.
Right. After Terrell had threatened to beat up Chiron after school And so Chiron was just kind of hanging around, and then Kevin had been in detention for a sexual experience.
On the stairwell.
On the stairwell.
With a female.
He says with a female.
Yeah.
And then when Kevin said to Chiron, but you're good at keeping secrets, then I wondered, you know, is Kevin on the down low?
I would assume maybe bisexual. He ends up having a daughter with a female later. Yeah. And maybe he's bisexual.
I thought just young. I thought he was conveying that message to Chiron. It was like this implied subtext of
I agree.
Sexual connection
energy. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, there was something there. And I also maybe he just was even like curious or questioning. Yeah. I think we all can agree that Chiron is gay.
Yes.
But I never really thought Kevin was gay until like we're sitting here having the conversation. I just thought he was young and he did this, and it's just kind of what it was.
Well, like the scene that somebody just mentioned, Brock did, about being, was it in the closet or somewhere, and where they unzipped their pants.
Grade school, something like that.
And so that seemed like it was Kevin and some other boy, and Chiron walked in on them, and mm-hmm. that just seemed like third grade boys.
Very developmental.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very interesting how all that was it was kind of wrapped around sexual content.
Yes.
All the secrets.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So Kevin already knew about that secret that Chiron had kept.
Mm-hmm. So I know you have some notes, Scott. I want to make sure we get into some of these things before I go off in a different direction.
So I want to go meta a little bit.
Okay.
So Leanne and I watched this together today without talking about it until we were recording. but one thing that happened is I always watch movies with the subtitles or captions on, and Leanne asked, do you always do that? And I'm like, yeah, because I feel like we get so much more information, including lyrics to songs and everything like that. So
there's conversation that you can barely make out
or
in this
all.
Movie or not at all that in that, I mean, I felt like I was watching a different movie almost.
Hmm.
And I highly recommend doing that. Do it on one just to see the difference. I don't even think it matters.
Well, like a particular scene where it was before we have met Teresa, and Juan is going to get Teresa, hoping that she'll be able to get Chiron to talk in the car. We cannot hear a word between Juan and Teresa. The captions, though, say everything from that dialogue. So
okay.
You can tell in some of our other podcasts that it's stuff that you've picked up that none of us, not because you're not brilliant, because you certainly are, but some of it I can see that it would be from that. It was very enlightening. I've started, I'm addicted.
I've started turning on the captions when I hear something that I don't understand. Like when she yells in the hallway, there was one time that it wasn't auditory at all. It didn't. Mm-hmm. It just had the video. And then the second time when I think it was like a flashback, he had a dream of his mother yelling in the hallway.
Yeah.
And I think it was "Don't look at me," and I couldn't understand what she was saying. And I turned on the captions and immediately thought Scott would be proud.
Yeah. So I'm just looking for some of the things that I read.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I just, you know, we were talking about sexuality and whatnot there, and then I'm remembering because I know you also you really focus on music a lot.
Yeah.
And the song that he chose that said he reminded him of Chiron.
Yeah.
Kevin chose.
Yes.
It was a strange song. Not at all what I was expecting.
Hello, Stranger.
Yeah.
I haven't seen you for a while. I thought what I inferred from that was there was a literalness to the lyrics. Mm-hmm. Hello, Stranger. You know, I have it written down. But.
And at the time he supposedly heard this for the first time, they hadn't seen each other. He hadn't called him.
Yeah.
So it makes sense in the diner. Hello, I'm just seeing you again, right? But when it reminds him, they haven't seen each other in a decade.
Yeah.
The story he's telling is very interesting.
Guilt. You know what I mean? Have you ever thought back and thought like, God, I wish I wouldn't have done that when I was a kid, and almost want to like call someone from 20 years back to apologize for something you did that. I mean, that we all do when we're kids, but I've never made the phone call and actually did it. And I think that's what Kevin was doing here, is making that phone call to be like, we're okay, right?
Yeah. Like some atonement or something.
Yeah. I mean, he kind of initiated this whole fight that ended up happening that sent Chiron to juvenile detention center, that sent him into this downward... I mean, I don't want to say downward spiral, because I think that that's such an... I'm making a negative reference.
Putting on a front, and literally fronts the gold teeth, and that Kevin then, now years later, is kind of calling him out on a little bit for his inauthenticity.
Anything you want to add, Brock? Did we lose Brock?
For Brock.
Unplugged.
Hopefully he's not. Are you there, Brock?
I'm here. Sorry.
Okay, just making sure.
What happened?
No, there's nothing I wanted to add. Sorry.
Usually when we record, I'm in Denver and everybody else is in DeKalb, and now we've switched it. So I am actually in front of people this recording, which is exciting, and Brock is not.
Just a quick moment of irony that I picked up from watching the subtitles. And so after the initial sexual encounter between Chiron and Kevin, and they're in the car, and Kevin says, "You ain't never done nothing like that before, huh?" Literally, there are crickets chirping.
Absolutely. And, I mean, when it goes later to where he's seeing Kevin for the first time again, he says, like, "No one has ever touched me before." And, like, he's never had another, I mean, which was a pretty mild sexual experience to begin with. But just that loneliness again and isolation to be at that age and never have been with anyone, never have had a sexual experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, this kid is suffering from some major PTSD and trauma. And I mean, I guess since we're kind of going down this and I'm talking about diagnosis and whatnot, again, I had my moment where I was like, you know, will he please just talk to a counselor or a therapist or something? And his mom even mentions it at one point. Like, have you ever thought about talking to someone? And he had a negative kind of reaction. She's like, even if it's just me. And it reminded me, because I actually have students currently who are giving a speech on this, that in the Black or African American community, counseling or mental health services are frowned upon even more than in stereotypical, you know, just existence.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're looking at just these very, you know, there's the gay thing, there's the poor, there's drugs, and then there's this mental health side that he's not going to get this service as well.
Yeah. There were some things related to, so we're now talking about Black.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the scene where he has just left his mom and he's driving to the diner where Kevin works. And it's I want to say it's in Florida because we've got the ocean on the side.
It's Atlanta to Miami, which is a 9.5-hour drive. He was not playing.
And, and we see like an overlay of children kind of playing in the water that is overlaid on his driving. And so we're getting all of these factors together. And then there's a Cuban song playing. And I unfortunately couldn't understand all of the lyrics, but I did pick up on that it was about the sad dove that flies in the air. And it's about this sad dove that's always missing her. And I really got that feeling, again, of complicated grief, like we had in Manchester by the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make at least one other music reference. There's a song by Aretha Franklin, and I didn't write down the name.
I have it. One Step Ahead.
One Step Ahead. And that song appears twice. It's right before the first time we meet Paula, and Juan is taking Chiron back home to Paula. And then it's right after the last time that we see Paula. And I thought it might have implied that this was going to be the last time that Chiron would see her as well. I only get that from the song structure of the placement and the parallel there. But there is, I mean, this idea of trauma and grief. And then, so we've got this Cuban song. Juan, of course, was Cuban. And then Black goes to Kevin's diner, or the diner where Kevin works. Kevin brings out the chef special, and it's Cuban. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's like everything is coming back together. And I think, you know, it's through this scene with final scene with Kevin, and then the scene in Kevin's apartment, and then we finally have a flash to Chiron, young Chiron, in the water, moonlight looking down on him, and he's reflecting backwards.
Is it moonlight? I thought it was day.
It's a hue. I'm not sure. I can't.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'll retract the moonlight. I want to say it has to be.
It feels like it should be.
And because the word moonlight flashes on the screen immediately right after that. But I feel like that Black has regained this authenticity of his youth through all of this unfolding. And it is only a flash,
a nanosecond of
a scene.
And see, I like what you said, and I want to, of course, we're going to all end up rewatching all these movies again. But I kind of saw that almost as a warning to the viewer that, like, the kids and young people, he's on the verge, literally on, like, the cusp of the earth, you know, standing there at the sea, and he has so much potential and can kind of go anywhere at this point. And based on just kind of the way life takes you, or the decisions we make, or the hand we're dealt, at that point, if you would have shown me that young boy who was just sweet and kind and really quiet and innocent, I would have never expected him to turn out to be the adult that he ended up turning out to be. Still a very nice man, it seems, but dealing drugs and completely alone and carrying a gun and just not what I would expect at all. And I thought it was just kind of this, like, look how life can be thrown at you, and just almost like a little warning to the viewer. Like, I don't know. That's kind of where I was seeing it. I don't know.
Sure.
And I kind of see the same thing. And then, but you see him when he's a small, kind of frail little boy. And now he's, you know, this kind of this big buff guy, you know, he's in the same place in his life, but he has changed.
Absolutely.
I saw it probably close to what Brock just said. I felt like it harkened back to, like, we've now seen Black, so Chiron, as an adult man. And I felt like that end sort of harkened back to the kid in him. So one of the things I noticed is that when he has at least two of the conversations he has with Kevin as an adult, he looks childlike in his face, which is fantastic acting. You see it when he finally starts to talk to him on the phone when he calls. There's just this, like, innocence to his face. It doesn't look hard anymore. I don't know how to explain it, but amazing acting. And then we see it when they're sitting across from each other in the diner talking. And so at the end of it, where you see this connection with the two of them, and then it goes to showing him as a child, I think that's what happened in my mind. And, like, he's back to that more authentic self when he's with this one he trusts. So maybe I didn't go as deep, but I like that idea as well.
And
trusting and belonging. And
Since you said it a couple of times, I just want to reiterate, the acting in this film
Holy cow, insane.
There was only, like, you know, in typical, I'm really critical of actors. I don't know why. I think that maybe I always wanted to be an actor when I was a kid and just never actually pursued it. But I'm always very critical of, like, scenes and whatnot, and thinking, like, there's moments that if I was the director, I would have been like, let's go back and try that again without this or doing this. And there's almost none in this film. There was only one time where I thought for a minute, like, Naomi Harris, who plays Tyrone's mother, I was like, she's a little too pretty and put together at some points when she's using drugs and maybe seems a little out of control. But she's also just a beautiful woman, and that could be part of it. But then I went and started doing some research, because that's what I do. And she filmed all of her scenes. And by the way, she's the only actor to be in all three chapters of the film. Everyone else changes. They use different actors for Kevin and Chiron. Right. And she, and the final scene, Teresa's not in it at all.
Teresa's not.
She's the only person who's in all of these. And they filmed her scenes in 3 days out of order. She only had 3 days and filmed all of those scenes changing like decades.
Wow.
I just thought it was incredible. After that, I was like, all right, I'm going to shut up about her being too pretty, because that was kind of amazing.
Well, so we have touched on this, but I just want to make sure we've covered all that we wanted to on the portrayal of masculinity. And so... So I want to go again back to the Juan telling the story about the old lady, and when, so, you know, I'm trying to think, what is the significance of the moonlight? And I think when I think of the moonlight and the water, when I think of the moon, I think of feminine archetype, and I wonder if we have, you know, that since there's that swirling around, that blending of masculinity and femininity, and you know, I think of the Lady of the Lake. So I didn't know if we had covered all that we wanted to on that.
I mean, when it does come to a little bit with that, I guess I do kind of want to throw something in, because I was thinking about it, and maybe this will also lead, I think there's something else you wanted to say. With the original name of the play, which In the Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, that was something else I was thinking of as well with the, kind of this phrase of moonlight, because I remember reading an article that, and it's not called dysthymia anymore, it's called prolonged depressive disorder. And a lot of young black men end up getting, or could be technically diagnosed with dysthymia because of the just microaggressions that happen over time. And I thought of the word blue makes black boys look blue. And that's kind of where I was seeing it, like this sadness, this emotional regulation and kind of a cultural thing in itself after microaggressions of years and years. Like, moonlight makes you look blue. Moonlight is almost life. You know what I mean? After life hits you so hard, eventually it can beat you down and you're sad.
And it's putting you in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting interpretation. I have to be honest that where my mind went when I first heard blue was that blue can also mean sexual.
What?
Like a blue joke is a sexual joke.
I have never heard that before in my life. Either. Have you ever heard that, Brock?
I will confirm or deny the accusation.
I don't understand the question, and I will not answer it.
Well, at a minimum, this movie shows, psychosocial development, right? We have stage 4 in chapter 1, stage 5 in chapter 2, and 6. So can you come up with that off the top of your head? I mean, you know what I'm talking about? So, like, when, like in stage 4 of psychosocial development, you've got, like, competence versus inferiority. So it starts with, you know, him being bullied and chased, and there's a general inferiority going on. So is he able in his life to develop in a healthy way just through this lifespan development that we just get to see, which is, what, 20 years worth? Of his world. So when you miss one or two or three, likely, number 6 stage is intimacy versus isolation. That's his adult life. That's what we see in chapter 3. That's the black stage. There is no intimacy in his life, as we've talked about. There certainly is isolation. Hopefully what happens, you know, is if this movie were to go on, then maybe that is kind of broken with this re-engagement with Kevin. And I mention this development just because I think it goes back to the idea of what you said, Adam, with that blue and that kind of depressive state. If you do not progress through these developmental stages, at a minimum, the result is going to be depressive behavior and future, that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And the stage after that, I believe, is generativity versus stagnation. And but in order to reach a subsequent stage, you need to successfully complete work through the previous stage.
Even if you continue to age.
And so, you know, and since I know a couple of entrepreneurs who are half of this podcast, I know that the idea of giving back, which is generativity, is hugely important. And here, you know, we're hearing about Black as an entrepreneur, and yet don't know if he has the opportunity for generativity.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Just another random thought. So after watching the film, I watched the trailer for the film. And, you know, and people are always worried about spoiler alerts and all of this. The trailer was very interesting because basically it begins at the end of the film. It's like the ending bits of the film and climax parts. That's how the trailer begins and then kind of moves backwards.
Hmm.
So that was just interesting to see it framed that way and to have that. And it even has that final little scene of the young Chiron in the water looking back. That's almost how the trailer opens.
Mm.
Like, yeah, I'm not even sure what it means, but thought I'd mention it.
And I just watched this for the first time, and I don't think it was on, it was not on our docket, but like 2 weeks ago. And I remember watching the trailer, and then after, I didn't know what I was watching. I just knew that it had won the awards and I should probably see it, because I miss seeing so many of those. And so I watched it and I thought afterwards, that is nothing like what I thought I was going to watch based on what the trailer had shown.
I agree. The trailer seemed a little misleading, but I like it and I love the movie.
Yeah. I was not disappointed.
So before we go into like kind of wrap up topics, is there anything else that we think we need to jump into? Brock, I also want to give you the opportunity because you're not here in person, so it's hard with nonverbals.
You're not seeing my nonverbals. I'm moving my arms, but no, I have nothing else. I mean, this is, you guys covered it all. This is great. I'm just enjoying the conversation.
Well, I'm just going to do a random couple other items from my notes, and then I'll be done. One is I'm kind of fixated in the past few films on the idea of repeating elements throughout a film, and I feel like if you see something more than once, it's going to mean something. And so one thing that came to my mind was the idea of Kevin's hands. And so how Kevin's hands are used in the initial sexual engagement, then Kevin's hands are used violently against Chiron, and then we see Kevin's hand so gently making this chef special with such care.
Yeah.
Well, I think that kind of goes into that complex relationship we were talking, where bad can be good and it's kind of interwoven.
Yeah.
The things that can bring you so much joy and pleasure can also really hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in one of the last scenes, he's rubbing his head so gently.
Mm-hmm.
It is
so
precious.
Yes.
It's just the head and the hands.
Yes.
It's all that you see, really.
Another thing that happened a couple times is the idea of rules. And so I don't remember exactly what they were called, but how Terrell provoked Kevin to punch Chiron several times. He's talking about, you know, those
knock
were...
Knock him down game.
The knock him down game. And those were the rules that we played by. And then in the diner, and Kevin says he wants Chiron to talk about who he is and what's been going on, and Chiron says he's not going to. And Kevin says, hey, it's grandma's rules. If you're going to eat, you got to talk. Which, by the way, that kind of goes back to Juan and Teresa.
That's what I thought
early on
to.
With mm-hmm. Chiron. And another song. So when Black arrives at the diner, really pounding hard is the song Classic Man, which I had never heard before, not familiar with. I looked it up and I saw an interpretation of that. It's about how much of a douche you can be as a classic man and still get laid.
Hmm.
And this intertwining.
Oh,
great.
Yeah, it's bringing all the elements together. Yeah, so I guess we'll end there for me.
Okay. And so I guess I kind of, as we're like wrapping this up, we kind of opened it up with this idea of just tell us a little bit about what you thought about the movie. I kind of thought it'd be nice to close because this movie kind of just ends. It doesn't give like a wrap up like a lot of movies do. It shows this scene that Leanne spoke of where he's receiving some sort of affection from Kevin. They're sitting together. He has his arm around him. He's kind of like stroking his hair a little bit, but we don't get any sort of release at the end where we're like, oh, he's going to be okay, or this isn't going to be okay, or we don't really know what's going to happen from here on out. So I guess I just wanted to get everyone's kind of 30-second interpretation that if this movie continued and we did see a wrap-up, what we think we would see for Chiron at this point. What would Chapter 4 look like?
You know what? What I'll say, just speaking from an African-American male standpoint, you know, it's like a never ending story. It's the same thing over and over. You know, so it kind of ties into, yeah, he's not getting better. It's the same situation, but that's kind of the eyes of how a black male lives. The same struggle.
Yeah.
Every day, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking something similar, that we would see Black or Chiron. We would see how he is maybe playing a Juan role with somebody else. But also, by the way, I loved I loved that we don't get a whole lot about Juan's death. We get two lines, mm-hmm. exactly. One by Paula about the funeral, and then one by one of the kids. Juan been dead 2 minutes or something like that. And so I'm assuming it was a drug-related death. And I'm guessing that. And I'm guessing that we would see Black Chiron mentoring somebody else and also dying an early death through the environment maybe that he's involved in.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't see like this being a happy ending. I saw him going back to Atlanta and continuing, like both you and Brock have said, that this wasn't like, oh, look, he's happy now. He's going to come out and they're going to live together. Like, this is not, this is it.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to be the girl. and kumbaya that, right? My favorite word. I would love that. I think you guys are right, though. You know, in that last conversation that the two of them have, Kev says, "Who is you, Chiron?" And he says, "I'm me. I'm not trying to be nothing else." And then they talk for a little bit more, and Chiron says, "I built myself hard." And Kevin's talking about his life, and he's talking about how the normalcy of it, and he has worries, but he doesn't have to worry about things that he used to have to. And he even says that it's some Bob Marley shit, which I love that line. But I think that this movie is about, you know, human connection and how these human connections form us,
mm-hmm.
and they can change our trajectory and make us who we are. And I think just these interactions do, but I will not kumbaya and think that they would end up.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you said that this movie is like a human connection, because this movie is about humans. It's not about black people. It's not about gay people. It's not about poor people. It's not about drugs. This movie is about humans and how we kind of bump into each other and how it changes our lives throughout the course of life. So I think that was a perfect
way. And it's told so well, because it could be about any of those things.
Absolutely.
They could have written this and with any of those other pieces being the highlight. But it's not. It's the connection that is. And I think that's what connects us to the movies and why I got the reward.
Amazing.
And it's Take Me Back to Manchester by the Sea. Yes. Because I think
takes me back to Soulless too. Solo. Oh,
yeah. This is the human condition. This is life. We are all flawed, but we're all doing the best that we can, and that's beautiful.
Absolutely. All right. So I think that's going to wrap up our discussion when it comes to Moonlight. I love this conversation. I love this movie. Thank you guys so much for, and I think it was Leanne who suggested this one. And the more I thought about it, I was like, great pick. So thank you so much for that. Scott, do you want to tell people where they can tune in?
Yeah, we are available on all forms of social media. Our main website is mentalillnessinpopculture.podomatic.com. But you can also find all of our podcasts on Facebook. Our Facebook page is mentalillnessinpopculture.com. We are on Twitter at MIINPC5. We are also available by email to mentalillnessinpopculture@gmail.com. And of course, downloadable through iTunes and most of your favorite podcast apps.
Awesome. And next week we are going to be talking about the movie Room. From 2015, it stars Brie Larson and Jacob Tremblay, and Brie Larson won the Academy Award last year for Best Actress for this one. I'm really excited about this one because it's also a book that I read, and I have a lot to say about it already. So,
and we're gonna take a little break in season two after that for a couple weeks, and then we'll be back with more.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see and talk to everyone next week. Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye-bye.